fine, mighty fine group tonight. I'm going to now study. We'll be talking about, I want to introduce the book first with just a few points by which we introduce it. Then we'll move on into the book itself. Now, I'm going to go rather slowly in the first part of it. A lot of part of it, I mean, in the middle of it, passages in there, portions with which you are familiar. You probably will not spend a great deal of time or go into detail except on some of the points with applications to our life and to our understanding of the Bible today. We began, of course, with an understanding of the word Genesis. The word Genesis simply means in the beginning. Now, most of the Hebrew books, those first five anyway, the name of the book actually is taken from the first word or words of the book. So the very first words of this book are in the beginning. Actually, Genesis then simply means in the beginning or beginning or beginnings. Now, it is a book of beginnings. I want to show that in just a moment. It's also a historical book as well as presenting truth. I mean, presenting specific things that develops a theme there. But it is largely a historical book there. Now, some of the translators, Luther, for instance, translated it the first book of Moses. Then Exodus, the second book of Moses, like that. But I think the old Hebrew concept here of beginnings is the better. Now, as to the author, we all recognize that Moses wrote it. The internal and external evidence presents the fact that Moses wrote the book. Although in the book of Genesis, Moses does not name himself. He is not named in that book at all. But we determine that from the external evidence as well as the other books that followed where he does mention the fact that God told him to write. Now, those of us who are conservative in our thinking, we all hold to the view that the book was written by one writer, and that was Moses. Now, liberal theologians have tried to make it a patchwork. They call it the priestly part of it and the Deuteronomic writers. And they've got four or five different writers, and they think they can go through and show where here one writer stopped and the other writer started, which is very ridiculous and very silly. And because it's written by one author, that one author is Moses. Now, the purpose of the book, I think there are two or three, there are several purposes of it. One is to give us a history of beginnings. Man could not know the beginning of creation and of man and of sin and of all of those things except it had been revealed to him by one that was there. God was there. God revealed it unto Moses. And so Moses, writing by the Holy Spirit, as God revealed these matters to him, has given us this account. Otherwise, we would have no idea about how things had the beginning. But in the first few chapters here, we have the beginning of creation. We'll deal with these later as we go along. The beginning of creation, then the beginning of man, the beginning of the home, the beginning of sin, the beginning of redemption, in about the third or fourth chapter there. Are five beginnings here in the first few chapters there. And we're going to stress these as we go along and point them out in detail. Here are beginnings. Well, we come on later. Then here is the beginning under Abraham. Abraham, the beginning of the fulfilling of the promise made to Adam and Eve when God said, I'll put enmity between thee and the woman, as to the devil, between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head and thou shalt bruise his heel. That's the first promise of redemption. We want to stress that when we come to it, point out what's involved in that statement. But at any rate, here are these various beginnings. Now, that's taken up with Abraham when we come to Abraham and goes on down through him. Now, there are several ways that you can, that's one of the important things, to give the history of beginnings. And then it also, the second thing, it shows how that God selected the nation or the people through whom that seed of the woman should come. that it was a matter of divine choice. And that's what Paul argues in Romans, the 9th chapter there, that the selection was a matter of divine choice. God chose the one through whom this Messiah would come. Right? Then there's another point. It traces this idea from the very beginning on down through the book. It traces then the promise of the coming of the Messiah. So you can think of it as beginnings, and then second, the selection of the kingdom through whom, or the person rather, through whom the kingdom would be developed by which the Messiah should come. Then it traces this one through the book. That is one of the most important parts of the book, I think, is the development of the promise of the coming of the Messiah set forth in the book of Genesis. Now, when it comes to outlining the, I might say just one word here on the text is prose. Now, some have tried to make it poetry, which it isn't. It does have some poetic expressions in it. For instance, when you come to Lamech and his two wives, and that's poetry. And I believe it's the 49th chapter, is primarily poetry. So you do have poetry interspersed in the prose of the book. Now, the best text, original text, is still in the Hebrew. Now, here's a thing you want to remember, class, in studying these ancient writings, is that as you read one translation, it'll be a little different from another translation and so on there. Why is that? Well, you have the old Hebrew text, and then you have the Septuagint. That's the Greek translation made in the 3rd and 2nd century before Christ, called the Septuagint. That's the one that the Christ and the apostles quoted, was the Septuagint. Now, they gave it that name because they said 70 men translated it in 70 days and all, which is not so. That's an old Jewish fable. But it was translated and given the name the Septuagint. And then, of course, as time went on in translating or transcribing the Hebrew into by another writer and another and on, over this period of so many thousands of years, then naturally you're going to have changes in that. Don't let that alarm you. It never has bothered me because I believe that God was able to preserve a text that would reveal the truth that he wanted revealed. Now, the original writers of the Bible were inspired. The translators were not inspired. Hence, the consequence, as a consequence, we have then these slight variations in our translation. If you try to remember that, it'll not alarm you. I remember when I was in school, and 50 years ago, a little over now, that the teacher brought this up. We were studying that idea of how we got our Bible, the text out. Big, thick book, about so thick there. We came to that idea. We had one young fellow in there. He was studying to be a preacher. That almost shook his faith. That just tore him all to pieces. The idea that we still didn't have the originals as written by the apostles or the prophets of the Old Testament. Well, a little thought would indicate that these are going to be worn out. So they wore out, men transcribed them and transcribed them. And what we have today is a transcribing of a transcription that eventually goes back to the original. But after you study the whole thing, I suppose that you could take a piece of paper about the size of your hand or two hands, and on that you could write all of the really confusing passages and the one that give trouble. And you think of a book as large as this, written by so many different men, transcribed over such a long period of time. We're amazed that it has come out so perfect as it has. That is not true of any of the histories of the Egyptians or the Babylonians or any of the rest of them. Their writings are filled with confusion, but not the Bible. So I say that you won't be worried about it. Now, I want to give a brief outline of this, if I may, for whatever it's worth. I'm going to put it down on the board, but let me run through here with you. Here's the word generation. Now, the first chapter, chapter 1 through 2 and verse 3, that's what I would call the introduction to the book. Here is an introduction to the book here in this passage, chapters 1, 1 through 2 and verse 3. Now you come to to 10 generations. That is that expression, the generation. The word simply means history. Doesn't mean the creation of anything, but the giving of the history of it. Now, if you want to go through your Bible and mark these, you may do so. Maybe it's a waste of time to look at this, but since this is a study and not simply a reading and a review of it, I'm going to take the time to do that. Now, in 2:4 here, you have here, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that Jehovah made the earth and the heaven. All right, here then, first of all here, you have in this first one, well, I'd have to write down the word introduction, generation all the way through. Here is the generation, and I'll just put a couple of dots under that. We simply mean the history. Here is the history now. All right, we've already told here of the creation, but now then, he goes into the history of it. All right, and that's from 2:3 over here to fourth chapter here and verse 26. All right, so that's from 2:4 here, 2:4 through 4:26. Now he's dealing with the creation of the generation, the history of the heaven and earth. I didn't put that down. Wait, let me get that. We'll just start off wrong here tonight. All right. Now here then, the generations of the heaven and the earth. All right. Now that's what we're dealing with first. Heavens and earth. All right. So that's 2:4 through 4:26. All right. That section. All right. Now instead of writing that out each time, we'll just try to put it down like this. Generations, or the history now, of man, or Adam. Let me get that correct. All right, now this is the book of the generations of Adam. All right, so here then, from 5:1 here through 6:8, the generations of Adam. All right, Adam and his descendants here. All right, now that's 5:1 through the 6th chapter and verse 8, I believe it is. All right, 6:8. All right, now the generation or history of Noah. Noah is next. All right, now you may not like this outline. I'm going to give you another one much simpler than this after a while. But it may be that you want this. All right, now here is the generations of Noah. All right, now that was 6:8. This will be 6:9 on through, let's look at this thing, of Noah, 6:9 through 9:29. Now, you may want to go through and look at that, remembering what you're saying. That's really the history of this. That's what the generations mean. All right, now next, the sons of Noah. Fourth, the generation of the sons of Noah. All right, that gives these various ones. All right, now that's from 10:1 to 11:9. That's where we'll come to our genealogy there and all of that. All right, 5, the generation or history of Shem. This will be short. All right, and here it is, the generation, the history of Shem. And you see kind of what we're getting to here, 11:10 through 26. 11:10 through verse 26 there. Just a short one. 6, the generation or history of Terah. All right, next now is the generation or history of Terah. I should have been putting the word of in there, but I see I didn't. All right, of Terah, 11:27 through 25 in verse 11. 25 verse 11. All right, the next here is that of Ishmael, which is very short. All right, the generation or history of Ishmael. Because you see, we leave him and go ahead into others at 25:12 through 18. Very short also. That doesn't mean that's the only time he's mentioned. He's mentioned other places. That is the generations of Ishmael. The next, 8, the generation, wait a minute, no, this is 6. That's right, this is 8, isn't it? All right, the generations of Isaac now. The generations or history of Isaac. Now, this will be a little longer here. 25:19 to 35:29. All right, ninth. I hear the generations or the history of Esau, Isaac and Esau. All right, now that would be chapter 36. That's the whole chapter on that. 36 now. The generations of, next is that of Jacob. All right, the generation or history of Jacob. All right, now that's from chapter 37 to 50. All right, that's where you see we're following him. Now, that is sort of an outline of the book. If you want to follow this idea of these generations. Now, you may want a different outline. If you wanted to follow, if you wanted just to trace Christ, then you would, if you were going to just follow him, Christ Jesus, I just bought him a board here. If you want to follow the genealogy of Christ, you'd find that, first of all, he's the son of Adam. Son of Adam, then you go on down to Seth, and then from Seth to Noah, and from Noah to Shem, and from Shem to Abraham, and from Abraham to Isaac, and from Isaac to Jacob. Now, if that's one way, and you can go through. I could divide that up into chapters, but I'm not going to. But you can do that for yourself. You want to follow just simply the idea of the Christ in that. He's the son of, he's the descendant of Adam and Seth, Noah, Shem, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, in the book. Now, there's a simpler outline of the book if you wanted to follow it, and that would be to make two divisions out of it. First of all, there is the history of mankind. All right, now here's mankind, and creation, right? If you want to put out creation and mankind here, that would be 1 through 11. 1 through 11. Or, in second, there are two divisions here. All right, now here we follow Abraham. The history of Abraham, chapters 12 through 50. Now some divide it up like that. Any of those that you follow will be all right in this matter. And you can follow it to suit, make your outline to suit yourself. Now, if you want to spend just a minute before we get into this, let me go through and you can underscore these generations if you want to. In 2:4, these are the generations of the heaven and the earth when they were created in the day that Jehovah made earth and heaven. All right, now that's 2:4. Then the next time you'll find the word is 5:1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. All right, you see it's the history. The history now of Adam here and his descendants. And that's from 5:1 on over to 6:8. All right, now they're beginning with 6:9. These are the generations of Noah. All right, 6:9 through 9:29 here. Generations of Noah, if you want to mark those, you can mark them when you get home, if you like. Now then, in 10:1, here are the generation of the sons of Noah, namely Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood. All right, now that extends on over to the 11th chapter and verse 9. And then you start with verse 10 of 11 and verse 10. These are the generations of Shem. All right, now you see we're leaving Japheth and Ham, and we're following the generations of Shem here in 11:10. Through verse 26. All right, just a little short one there. Then we come to generations of Terah. All right, Terah in verse 27. Now these are the generations of Terah. And that goes on through 25:11. A long one there as we follow his generation. So the book does have, it has, the writer used the divisions there and had a definite goal there in what he was doing. Then you come to 25:12, the generations here of Ishmael. All right, now that would be by Keturah, don't you see? 25:12 through 18, very short there. Then beginning with verse 19 of chapter 25, These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. That's from 25:19 through 35:29. Goes on through 35:29. All right, then you have your 35:29. Then you have the generations here of Esau, chapter 36, and then the generation 37:2 here. And these are the generations of Jacob. All right, so if you want to mark those, I'd suggest you go through and mark them. And so that you have that generation idea. But remember, what he's following here is the history of these individuals. It's the history now of these. So there is plan, what I was trying to say a moment ago. There is plan to the book. And you'll be impressed with that, I think, as we go through our study. Well, so much for that, unless you have a question. Any question over that? Just remember that generation there simply means here the history of the descendants of this one. And moving on, and in all of it, we can see that what he is doing is following a particular line through there, from Adam to Seth to Noah to Shem, and then Abraham, and so on there. All right. Now, let's turn to the text itself. In the beginning, God. There are three words there that I want to note tonight rather carefully as we study this. We're not going to be taking a word-by-word study of this book by any means, but there are some words that we do need to consider. All right, now here are three words I want to look at. In the beginning. All right, that tells us back to the time before which there was nothing. All right, in the beginning, God. All right, we want to look at that for just a moment. God created the heavens and the earth. All three of these words, I think, are very important to study of this. Now, the beginning here goes back to when nothing existed. The absolute beginning. Now, when that was, I have no idea. People say 7,000 years. I don't accept that because I don't know whether it's so or not. Others say 7 billion years. I don't accept that either because I don't know whether that's so or not. So, frankly, my statement is I don't know when the beginning began. I don't know that. Nobody else does. So I've never seen any use in arguing that. All I argue is when you get to the beginning, God. God created. I used to tell my students you ought to go to the board and write down a 1 and put a lot of naughts clear across it there. And all those are years. Why, I might not accept it. I'm not going to argue with you about it. All I argue is when you get back to the beginning, God created. Now, I don't think the world's as old as these modern so-called scientists think it is, but it probably is older than in 7,000 years. I feel confident that it is. I don't think man's been on it over 7,000 or 8,000 years, so that would put it back to about then. So we don't know when it was, and so let's not argue that. We just get back to the absolute beginning. All right, now in the beginning, God. Now, we find this beginning a number of times in the New Testament. The devil sinned from the beginning. You get back there to the beginning, the devil already was. Now, where he came from, we're not going to argue that right now. We will later. All right, in the beginning, God. Now, this is from the word Elohim. All right, and this is plural. Elohim. All right. Now, this is a plural word. Now, some have tried to see in that the Trinity or the Father, Son, or the Spirit. Now, that developed later. That's true. But that this was in the mind of the writer when he wrote, I doubt. I think what this word means here, the root word for Elohim is fear. Fear and reverence. And the plural here indicates unity here in the three persons of the Godhead, or unity in God. God's fullness or completeness. For it's used, God is used with the singular verb. Right? So, there was no intention there of making it a three persons in the Godhead. That was not the idea. There were three persons, all right. But this is Jehovah God, the great eternal one. What in the beginning? God. That word God is found 2,570 times according to one writer. Now, whether that's right or not, I'm not going to take the time to look and see. But one fellow claims it's found 2,570 times in the Old Testament. Maybe it is. It's Elohim, or God in a plural, that indicating His perfection, completeness, fullness, His absoluteness. But this word indicates then the root to fear or reverence one. Also, I think it indicates His omnipotence and His omniscience. Now, I know it's created. This word created comes from a Hebrew word. I'm not sure whether it's baru or bara. I believe it's bara. I found it spelled both ways here. It doesn't make any difference. I know it's found bara most of the time, and baru at times, and I know there'd be some difference in that. I don't know what the difference is, because I don't know Hebrew. But I want to look at this idea of created. This idea means to create out of nothing. Now, incidentally, I failed to bring my, this doesn't have a New Testament in it, but there are two or three words I want to look at. In Hebrews 11 and verse 3, here it says, by faith we understand that the world had been framed out of nothing, so that what is seen hath not been made out of things which appear. You remember the passage, 11 and 3. Now, I think that is the clearest explanation of the idea of creation out of nothing. By faith we understand that the worlds have been framed, doesn't it say, from nothing? What did it say there? From nothing? I think I quoted it right, but I'm not, it was from many of them, I'm not sure. All right. At any rate, the world was framed out of nothing. That, so the things which are seen have been not been made out of things which appear. Hebrews 11 and 3. I should have brought my testament. This one doesn't have any. Ma'am? Now, what version are you using? What does the standard say? Just, don't just read it. That's all. That's the way it was. Didn't say nothing, but being, well, not made out of things which appear. Now, that's one of the clearest statements, I think, of all that. Now, you have two or three other statements there that we'll be noticing a little bit later on. In John 1, 1 to 3, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, divine, deity. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that hath been made. And Him was life, and the life was the light. And then we'll look at that a little bit more later on. Right, then again, because we're going to study this word in just a moment, I'm a little ahead of myself here, but that's all right. Now in Colossians 1, about verses 15 to 17, when it says of Christ, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in Him were all things created, in the heavens and upon the earth, things visible and things invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through Him and unto Him, and He is before all things, and in Him all things consist. Now, while we're on that, look at Psalm 33 and verse 6 there, and also verse 9. Psalm 33, 6 and 9, where here the psalmist says, by the word of Jehovah were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of His mouth. Then down to verse 9, for He spake, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. Those two passages are good to have in the same connection here. Psalm 33, verse 6 and verse 9. All right, so here this idea here, created, comes from the idea of an absolute creation from nothing. So the things which are made have not been made out of things which appear. So it's made out of something other than that. All right. Now, back to our idea here. So that of a divine creation was arguing. Now the next verse says, by created the heavens and the earth here. All right. We'll look at that a moment now, and we would say the universe. All right, and this, wait a minute, and the earth, the heavens and the earth, all right. Now the heavens and the earth We would simply say the universe, but I understand that the Hebrews had no word for a universe. So here the heaven and earth then, that means the universe or the all, the total of things created. Now, men have been confused over this and tried to make a lot out of it that I don't think is there. When they try to make here was a creation, and then a fall, and another creation. That's not so. This statement here simply summarizes the creation of all things by God. Now then, and the earth was waste and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Now let's look at that for just a moment. And the earth here was waste and void. Now what do these two words mean here? Waste and void. All right? As we look at these words here, the word waste is from a word that means unformedness. Unformedness. Hence then, it hadn't been formed, not yet put into shape, is what this word means. Unformedness, that is not yet put into shape. All right, so here then, we think then of this mass of created material, not as chaos exactly, but it hadn't been put into the shape that later on God put it into, the idea there. Then he says second here, this next word here, waste and void. Now the word void comes from a word that means emptiness, that is uninhabited. There were no living inhabitants, either animal, either fish or bird or animal or man upon it. It was simply uninhabited. Here's the meaning of that expression there. Emptiness, uninhabited. Now I think that we understand that more clearly a little bit later when we come to the creation. Now notice here, and darkness was upon the face of the water, or rather, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep. Here that deep, evidently the turmoil here of all of this material God had made in dark, clothed in absolute darkness. All right, and I don't try to understand that. I don't try to comprehend it. I can't, because here what God made here, and the turbulence of it was in darkness. Now then, the first thing that God created in that, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. All right, now here we have God up here, Elohim. Now here the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. Now some have tried to make that to mean brooded. That's not a good word. To hover is better. A bird broods over the eggs, doesn't it, till they hatch. But then it hovers over the young birds after they're hatched. Right, what you have here then is that it hovers. Now that word, the brood there, was introduced by individuals who were trying to follow the old Egyptian Babylonian myths, that here was an egg and the thing was created out of an egg and the spirit brooded upon that egg. Well, that's not so. No, the Spirit of God moved upon it. Now, the Spirit of God is the Holy Spirit that moved upon it or hovered over it there. Hence then brought the order out of the condition that it was in. It moved upon the face of the waters. I don't like the word brooded there, but rather moved or hovered over it upon the face of the water. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. Right now here. Here God said. Now when you come to that, here you do have the triune God here. When you have God said, there you have the Word of God. All right? Now here is God, Elohim, the supreme God here. Here the Spirit of God hovers over it. Now comes God said, now you have the active agent in the creation. All right? Now you come back to these passages here, John 1. In the beginning was the Word was God, all things were made through Him. Then in verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. Glory was the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Here, Colossians 1, all things were made through Him. And here in this one here, by the Word of God were the heavens created, by the breath of His mouth were they brought forth. God spoke and it was brought forth. So actually, though I don't look at this as including the three persons of the Godhead. Now this is not developed here. That's developed later. The idea of the three persons in the Godhead is developed later. But you do have the three here in this first three verses here. God created, that is the originator of Him. Now there's another fine verse there if you like, and that's Revelation 4 and verse 11. Where here, the 24 elders here, sing a song saying, "Worthy art thou, O Lord our God, to receive the glory and the power and the honor, for thou didst create all things, and because of thy will they were and were created." That's become a real meaningful passage to me in the last number of years. That is, that here, because of thy will, they were and were created. That is, here, before the creation, they existed in the will of God. They existed in the mind of God. So here in God's will, these things existed. And now then, by thy will, they were and were created. I think that's a very significant passage. Revelation 4:11. Might jot that down and look at it in the same connection here, for it's become very meaningful to me in the last 10 or 12 years. Back of that, I paid no attention to it. But when it came to impress me, I see now that the creation was in the mind of God. Right now, that tells us back here then to the creation, and you've seen me draw this little diagram many, many times here. Here is eternity back here. Here is eternity, right? And here in this eternity is God's purpose. Now, God, when he made man, there was a purpose there. But now, then, not only that, but here was the will that brought forth the existing creation. So as he planned the purpose, the creation of man here, here then he created a world here that was suitable for man. He made a world that was suitable for man and made man a creature to fill that world that he had made. So I think you have two thoughts there that to me are very significant. That is, that here in God's eternal purpose back there of the creation of man and the redemption of man if man should sin, then here is the physical creation, the material creation, is because of thy will they were and were created. So here you have God's plan or purpose in the creation for the creature man whom he purposed to create and put there, and also in his mind was the plan of salvation if man should sin. You've heard me say several times, I don't argue whether God knew he would or he wouldn't. I simply say that to me, God was able to create a being capable of making a choice independent of God's foreknowledge of what he would do. And therefore, when man sinned, God had a plan for his redemption. Man hadn't sinned, God had a plan for man in this world that he made for him. I don't know what that one was, because that one's not revealed. Man sinned, therefore that's not revealed. I believe that Ephesians, the first chapter, teaches that, and as well as some other passages, 1 Corinthians 2, 6 through 13, and others there. All right, let me move on now. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And that was evening, and that was morning, one day. That's presented a little problem to us, a little trouble to us here. But you'll notice it, and it was good. Then he separated or caused a division between the light and the darkness here. That's an interesting thing to me, and I don't know whether this is a place to bring it out or not. Very interesting to me that there are a number of words here that are used 10, 7, and 3 times. As you read this Old Testament, I want you to note these particular number of times, 3, 4, 7, 10, and 12. How that these are the numbers that occur so often back here. Right, now, in this first chapter here, God said is found occurs 10 times here. God said. Right, that's found 10 times. I don't know whether this is worth our spending my time on or not. It is significant to me. I went through and counted them this afternoon and underscored them. Now, you can do the same if you like. And there was. That's occurred 7 times. And there was. All right? That's 7 times. Well, 7 is the perfect, complete number. 10 is a full number, the full or complete number. And then you have another 7 times. That good. God said it was good. Later he said it was very good. Last there. That's found 7 times also. Then you have, and he called. And he called 3 times. I just want to say a little bit about this, whether it amounts to anything or not. That's found 3 times. And then, and he blessed. That's found 3 times. And he blessed. All right? That's three times. Now, did Moses go through and count this? To be sure he used the word that many times, I don't know. But it's interesting to me that he did. I found the same thing in studying the book of Revelation and in writing the commentary on it. How often the 3, the 4, the 7, the 10, the 12 occur? And all of them are significant. There is a significance there. Now, 3 is the divine number. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I don't think that that was included in this. But nevertheless, that is the divine number. 4 is the world number. That's the world number. That's the creation number. Of creation. And 7 is the perfect number. 10 is the power number or fullness or completeness. And 12, the religious number. You'll notice that as you go along. I want you to note that as you're studying Genesis. We're going to try to make this a real study and not just running over it, but really study. Right? And it was good, and God divided the light. We've already suggested that here. All right? Now this day. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning one day. Now this idea of evening. Evening means going into a thing. So going into the night, into the end of the day. Now, what time the day started, I don't know. But now when you come to the end of it, and then here the next dawn is appearing, now you have your day there. Now, of course, that's given scholars a lot to discuss over these 24-hour days over the great periods of time. I think that's another foolish thing to discuss. I accept that they were 24-hour days. Here when he says that. Now, whether there was time in between the first, a period between the first and the second day, and all of that, I don't argue that. I don't know. There's no use to argue something you don't know and can't know. All we can know is what God said. God said that was evening and that was morning. That is, here the day comes to a close, goes into the night, and the morning dawn, you have one day. That was your day and your night there. Then you have another day and another night there, extending into it. So we've got to accept that, the evening and the morning. The evening terminates the day. The day's work is over. And the morning terminates the night. Now we're ready for a new day of work. Right? And the evening simply means to go. So here it goes. The day goes. Here you go into the evening. The evening goes. Comes from a word that meant to go, I have read. Alright? So now this is the first day here. We're just accepted that it was a 24-hour period. And if there's any period between the days, I don't know a thing about that. And no use to argue. We don't know, and I just accept what God said about it. Well, that's the first thing. At the first end of the creation of the heaven and the earth and light, these came. And now second is the firmament. And God said, all right, here's our same expression here. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Now it seems that up until this time, the earth was covered with a thick, heavy fog. At least it seems that way. That's the best I'm able to explain it here. And now then, the waters above. Now down in Texas last week, wasn't it? They had 11 inches of rain and 23 down in Florida there in one place there. That means there was a lot of water up there, wasn't there? A lot of water. Out here's the water above in the clouds, and here's the water beneath here. And the firmament in between here, in between the two, except for the space. There is space known as the firmament, in between there. Now, the word heaven, we'll look at that in a moment. Now, the waters are separated. Here are the clouds of the water. And now, you'll notice here now, let there be a firmament, and God made the firmament. Now, that's not the word creation. It's not the same word that you have up above. That word occurs about 3 or 4 times. Now, notice me as we go along that created. Now, this is a different word. It simply means to make. And here then God made the firmament out of what already was. It didn't create anything. He just separated the waters there. That's all. The waters are now separated. All right? Now notice further here the word heavens. The firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so, and God called the firmament heaven. That comes from a word that meant to heave or to push up. And of course, if you look up and see the heavens yonder, push up there some way. That's what the word comes from. The heavens, they call that great expanse, the heaven. That was the second day. But we'll figure out the next day. Unless you have a question, we'll not spend too much time on it. Any question on that? Move into the third day now. And God said, now you notice you keep having that God said. You have it 10 times in this chapter. You want to go read it sometime? Notice how many times that God said and how many of these other times here. I think you'll find it interesting. And I think there's a point to that. I don't know that Moses really counted or not, but I think the Spirit directed him in that. There was meaning in that. Now God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together unto one place. Now that one place means literally one bed. One bed. And let the dry land appear, and it was so. I think God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together the waters called his seas. And God saw that it was good. That raises this question in our thinking, if we want to
I'll think a little bit about that into one place. But how? How was this accomplished? Well, if there was water everywhere, what did he push up the mountains here, to push up here certain areas, or did he push down, or how did he do it? Turn to the 104th Psalm, which may give you an idea. I have often wished that I have a little geology, but I don't. And I've often wished that I had faith. When I see these, you've seen these rocks out here. Here they're looking down like that as if somebody pushed them up. It seems they were pushed up. Now here is this 104th Psalm here, and about verse 7 to 9. 104, 7 to 9, here it is. At thy rebuke, well, let's go back just a little bit here. Thou covest it with a deep and with a dash. Well, I'm going to start back with verse 5. Who laid the foundations of the earth, that it should not be moved forever? Thou covest it with a deep as with a vesture. The water stood above.